On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It gets more and more difficult to be a man in America because it seems like so much of the scholarly information continues to blame men for everything. And this is not to say that there aren't men that behave badly, that's for sure. But is it the fault of men? Are they inherently bad? Is it a DNA thing? Is it a culture thing? And if so, for those of us who are Christians, what does that mean for Christian men? To visit with us today and to talk about her new book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes, we welcome Professor Nancy Piercy, who is the best-selling author of Love Thy Body, The Soul of Science, Saving Leonardo, Finding Truth, and Total Truth. She's professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, has been quoted in The New Yorker and Newsweek, highlighted as one of the top five women apologists by Christianity Today, and hailed in The Economist as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. Nancy, thank you for making time to talk to us today on The Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
We get a lot about men are bad, 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 and this just seems to be kind of a screed. But your research has showed that Christian men who take their faith seriously are doing better as our responsibilities as loving our spouse, not beating them up, and so forth.
Right. Well, this is the reason I wrote the book, really. I was looking into the academic literature, sociologists, psychologists. They were studying Christian men and coming up with these fascinating findings showing that Christian men do very well. And that is so counter to the cultural narrative, which tells us that evangelical men are exhibit A of toxic masculinity. It was really easy for me to find examples, but I'll give you just one. This was the co-founder of the Church Too movement, which came after the Me Too movement. And she said, the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today. And so what happened is social scientists, like psychologists, sociologists, they were listening to this and saying, you're making these accusations, where's your evidence? You know, you're making all these charges, where's your data? And so they went out and did the studies. And in my book, I quote some dozen studies or so that all found out that evangelical men, like you put it, who are sincere in their faith, attend church regularly, test out as the most loving husbands and fathers. They interview the wives separately, which is important. So what they're saying is that the wives report the highest level of happiness with their husbands' love and affection. Evangelical fathers spend the most time with their children of any other group, 3.5 hours more per week than secular men. Evangelical couples divorce at a lower rate than any other group, 35% lower than secular couples. And then the real surprise is that they actually have the lowest level of domestic abuse and violence of any group in America. And like I said, I was having to dig into the academic literature to find this stuff. So I said, I've got to get this out there. I need to let people know. You know, our churches need to know this, that Christian men are doing well. And then it's also very important for bringing into the public arena, too, to help counter, to debunk the secular narrative that Christian men are toxic. No, this is not just a pep talk from a religious leader. This is evidence-based findings from the social sciences that show that Christianity does have the power to reconcile the sexes, as I put it in the subtitle of my book.
Nominal Christians, that is to say, essentially people who went and joined a church at some time, but they're not actively involved in a church. They're not even sort of actively involved in a church, and they're not really following the guidelines of the Bible, that those men do show up as being much different on the scale than committed Christians.
Yeah, so the first pushback I always get is, but wait a minute, haven't we all heard that Christians divorce at the same rate as the rest of the culture? In fact, in my research, I found that that is one of the most widely quoted statistics by Christian leaders. And so the social scientists went back to the data, and they separated out, like you said, the men who are really committed Christians versus the nominals. By the way, I've met people who didn't know what nominal meant, so I have to tell them. N-O-M is Latin for name, so it does mean in name only. And so these are men who, in a survey like this, might check the Baptist box, for example, but who attend church rarely, if at all. It's more of a family background, a cultural background. And the shocking thing is that these men do test out quite differently. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness. They spend the least time with their children. They have the highest rate of divorce, even higher than secular men, 20% higher. And the real shocker is they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence, even higher than secular men. And this is why the statistics are so misleading, because if you just do an umbrella study of evangelicals, you're going to get men who are better than secular men, and you're going to get men that are worse than secular men. So it was very important to separate this out. So the church knows what they're dealing with, right? They can be supportive of the men who are living out their faith, because they're beaten down, too. Here's a story from my classroom. I told my class I teach at Houston Christian University, and I told my class that I was writing a book on masculinity. And one of the male students shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us." Oh, even at a Christian college. But then the church also needs to figure out how are they going to reach out to these nominals who are, in a sense, destroying the reputation of evangelicals because they're claiming an evangelical identity. But they're taking words like headship and submission and importing secular meanings of dominance and control and entitlement and so on. And so they're not giving it a biblical meaning. They're giving it a secular meaning, and then people think, oh, look, this is what evangelicals are like. So how can the church reach out and disciple these men better so that they can begin to understand what the Bible really teaches about husband-wife relationships?
Part of the problem is that the culture itself has become post-Christian. That is to say that there's not as much Christian influence in the culture, and so the culture doesn't support the sort of thinking that men and women are equally valid and equally loved by God, but have different roles to play. And being the head of the household does not mean being the dictator of the household. It just means eventually somebody has to have the yes vote. One of the things that you found in your research is that in most seriously Christian families, there is more of a sharing of a responsibility than are usually given credit for it. And I will say that my wife and I got married in the mid-70s, and we decided right up front that we were going to make decisions together, and we did that. Eventually, we worked out how we were going to do it, but we never really felt like, okay, you've got to make the decision because you're the guy, and I just got to put up with it. Instead, it was, what's the best thing for the whole family? What's the best thing for you and me? What's the best thing for the kids? That seems to be more of the norm among the committed Christians than among the nominal.
Very much so. It's great to hear your story, because that's exactly the kind of stories that the Christians told when they were surveyed. Like, you know, I did a lot of, this is my most fact-based book. I did a lot of studies from the sociology, from history. Some people have said, well, why didn't you go to the Christian leaders and ask them what they think complementarian means? And I said, because I wanted to find out how real, live, ordinary Christians live it out. Because the secular media says, if you believe in any sense of male headship, that will turn men into these overbearing, tyrannical, oppressive patriarchs. And so I wanted to find out, does it? You know, that's an empirical question. You go and ask the actual couples. And I was blown away by how positive the findings were, that when they actually talked to couples, they talked the way you just did, you know, that even the couples who believe in headship had such a loving, respectful, mutual understanding of headship. They didn't use language like tiebreaker or final authority or breadwinner. The most common phrase was spiritual leader. You know, when they were asked, you know, what do you think headship means? Spiritual leader was the most frequently cited answer. And what they were asked, what does that mean? They said, well, first of all, getting your family to church on Sunday, getting your kids to youth group, having family devotions, family prayer. But they also talked a lot about the intangibles of just feeling responsible for the spiritual health of your children, you know, feeling responsible for the spiritual well-being of your wife. And so their understanding of headship, well, it was Ephesians 5. That was also a surprise. The most frequently cited verse in these studies by Christian couples was, "Husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church." And the reason that was so interesting is because later when I talked about the nominal Christians who have a high rate of domestic violence, most of them didn't even know that verse existed. I literally have quotes from people saying, I had to look it up myself. I didn't even believe it was there.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
There was one abusive man who was being, there's a Christian pastor who works with abusive men in court-ordered counseling. They don't usually go into counseling unless it's court-ordered.
Yeah.
But he was violent with his wife. His wife had moved out. she had a protective order. He was violating the protection order. And the pastor said, and the abusive husband kept saying, my wife is wrong. Ephesians says she's supposed to submit to me. She needs to come back home. And finally the pastor said, have you read a few verses down? Have you read the part to husbands? And he said the man was shocked. He had never heard husbands love your wife as Christ loved the church.
And was willing to die for her. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Submitting doesn't sound as ominous when you say, but on the other hand, the husband should be willing to die for his wife, as Christ died for the church. We're talking, in case you're joining us late, to Nancy Piercy, who is the author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. It's from Baker Books, a division of Baker Publishing Group, available at bookstores everywhere and online. So one of the things that really fascinated me about your book is I had read a book back last December,
The History of Abortion in America by Marvin Alasky,
with Roe v. Wade being overturned, et cetera, et cetera. It talked about how the Industrial Revolution changed things. And when I read your book, I realized, oh my gosh, she's got even more information about how much it changed things. And all of a sudden, all the coins drop, because now it makes sense. Do you want to do sort of a little historical journey for us, starting with the colonial era and what that was like for households?
Yeah, a lot of people wonder where the concept of toxic masculinity came from. And they'll say, well, maybe 1960s, second wave feminism. No. It goes all the way back to the Industrial Revolution, because prior to that time, men worked all day with their wives and children, right, on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so the cultural expectation on men was very much a caretaking ethos. You know, they were responsible for their family. And even the concept of authority, it didn't mean, you know, I get to do what I want. It meant you have responsibility for the common good of your family, of your marriage, and so on. And, of course, at that time, America was largely Christian as well.
Mm-hmm.
The Industrial Revolution took work out of the home, and that caused a huge shift, because all of a sudden men had to leave the home into offices and factories. And for the first time in American history, they were not working with people they loved, with their family. And they were working as individuals in competition with other men. And this is when you start to see the language change. People began to protest that men were no longer operating by that caretaking ethos. They were no longer functioning by a biblical ethic. And young men were particularly hard hit, because with their fathers out of the home, they no longer had a strong day-to-day role model of what it meant to be a man. And so especially when the young men were coming into the cities, they were leaving behind the structures of accountability, right? The family, the church, the neighborhood, the village. And so they were falling prey to the vices that were more common in the city. And so in the 19th century, we saw a huge increase in drinking, gambling, fighting, crime, prostitution, and abortion. And abortion is the one that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the... a response to that was there were a lot of reform movements in the 19th century, too, trying to counter all of this, right? The temperance movement to counter all this drinking, the alcoholism became a huge problem. Sometimes a single fact will crystallize it. In 1830, Americans drank three times as much as they do today. So alcoholism was a huge problem, and men were coming home drunk and beating their wives and children. You know, they were drinking away the family money and leaving their families destitute. So there was a reason that there was a temperance movement, there was an abolition movement, there were movements to counter prostitution, sex trafficking, and abortion. So a lot of what we're seeing today, the sort of I think what we're seeing today is a double standard, where in a sense we expect women to hold men in check, right? It's almost like we expect men to be more prone to sin and vice,
mm-hmm.
ever since the 19th century, and we expect women to start these reform movements to counter them, to hold them in check, which is kind of what the Me Too movement was, right? It was women
right.
standing up and saying, men, you know, you need to stop acting so badly. And so that dynamic started in the 19th century. And if we want to stand against a social trend, we have to ask, where did it come from? How did it develop? So it's important to be able to trace where it came from so that we understand better how we can counter it today.
There were men that supported the abolition movement, who supported temperance, who supported women's suffrage, because if men hadn't voted for women's suffrage, because women couldn't vote yet, it wouldn't have passed. The reason that men were only allowed to vote initially is that it was really more defined than that. They had to be people who were landowners and therefore had something at stake in the votes that were cast.
Yeah, one of the questions that people often pick up on in the book is it turns out that women's suffrage was not initially supported by very many women. Even the suffragists, the Elizabeth Cady Stanton and so on, the women, the early feminists who were promoting women's suffrage, they themselves said the main opponents were other women. People were so skeptical of this, by the way, that I had to put quotes in the book to prove
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
I do. I have the quotes there, and then I have the quotes from the anti-suffragists. Why would they be against women's suffrage? Here was the answer. Back then, it was not framed in terms of men's vote versus women's vote. It was framed in terms of household vote versus individual vote. And a lot of women were afraid that an individual vote would take the responsibility off men to care about the entire household. You know, as long as they were legally held responsible for the entire household. Remember I said authority meant, you know, responsibility for the common good?
Mm-hmm.
So many women were afraid that if the vote changed from household to individual, that was letting men off the hook. It was saying, men, you don't have to worry about your whole family anymore. You can just vote whatever you want, whatever you think is best for you. That's the main reason that women opposed it, is because they thought it was taking responsibility off men, and they didn't want that. They wanted men to have a sense of responsibility for the entire household. Now,
right.
Eventually women did come to support the vote, but you know why? It was not because of... here's how the early feminists framed the vote in terms of autonomy and individual rights. As long as they framed it that way, most women didn't support it. But eventually, the temperance movement started to frame the vote in terms of protecting the family against drunken husbands. Literally, they argued that women who were being, you know, abused by drunken husbands had very little recourse. But if they had the vote, they could vote intemperance.
Right.
And then that would help protect. In fact, the temperance movement actually reframed the women's suffrage as the ballot for home protection.
Hmm.
Home protection. Well, when it was rephrased as home protection, then women supported it.
Sure, sure.
So that's how it finally got passed.
Now, you also bring up how Darwinian evolution played into this idea that men were toxic, that men were barbarians and needed to be tamed. Concept of social Darwinism that pretty much infused all kinds of research thought that men must necessarily be this kind of way, and therefore the only thing that contained them was women. What did you find that was the most dangerous of the Darwinian social Darwinism as far as how it affected the family?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's one of the most surprising parts of the book, because most people think of Darwinism in terms of science, like fossils and genes, but it actually had a tremendous impact on the secular view of masculinity. It was an important stepping stone in the development of a secular script for masculinity, because Darwinian writers began to say that in the struggle for survival, the men who came out on top would be ruthless, brutal, savage, barbarian, and sexually predatory. And they said that to recover your manhood meant getting in touch with the animal core of your nature. So Christians had urged men to live up to the image of God in them, but the Darwinists was telling men to live down to the beast within. That
right.
was their favorite phrase, the beast within. And so this is not just historical, because, yeah, you're right, it was called social Darwinism. Today it's called evolutionary psychology, but it's the same thing. You know, the body has evolved, and therefore so has the brain, all our ideas, all our feelings. And so I'll give you one example. It was a best-selling book called The Moral Animal, and the author argues that the human male, this is a direct quote, the human male is a possessive, oppressive, flesh-obsessed pig. Giving a man a book on how to have a better marriage is like giving Vikings a book on how not to pillage.
Ooh.
So that's an extremely negative view of masculinity.
Yes.
And, I mean, it's extremely derogatory, demeaning to men. And there's another book that has come out recently. It's an older book that just was reissued called Men in Marriage. It makes the same arguments, that men are naturally violent, sexually predatory, irresponsible. Their deepest longing is to jump on their motorbike and head off into the sunset, you know, be a lone ranger,
yeah.
leave wife and family behind. And then he concludes, it's up to women to tame these men. The women have to civilize these. To which I say, if men were really that rude, crude, and lewd, then what woman would want to civilize them, and what woman would have the power to? I mean, men are stronger, bigger,
right.
Stronger, faster. You know, it's kind of irresponsible to say it's up to women to tame them. I say, no, it's up to them to take God's rules for manhood. The book Men in Marriage literally says men need to adopt the woman's morality, to which I say, no, men need to take God's morality. God's morality is what they should be governing their lives by. They should be figuring out what it means to have a biblical, healthy concept of masculinity from God's definition.
That's really the key, isn't it? The problem that was exacerbated by the move due to the Industrial Revolution of men out of the home all day, it is possible to stay connected to your wife. It is possible to stay connected to your children because, I'll be honest with you, I, like most of the dads that I know, are just crazy for a kid. Now, my kids are grown now, but I still miss them, but they mean a lot to us. We became parents because we wanted to become parents, and we wanted to raise children and raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. That's the key to it, isn't it? That's the key to turning this around, is getting men to go back to God and to incorporate what the Bible says about being a man and about being a husband and about being a father, and take that stuff seriously.
What I think is cool is that the biblical ethic winds up with the sociological data. There's a study that was done. It was the first ever cross-cultural study of concepts of masculinity. And the researcher was not a Christian, but what he found was, even if cultures differ some, you know, in their understanding of what masculinity is, they all share the expectation that the good man will perform what he calls the three P's. In other words, a man will provide, protect, and procreate, become a father, have a family, build into the next generation. And this was fascinating because this was all around the globe. These were not cultures with a Christian background. There seems to be an inherent, innate knowledge that's universal of what it means to be the good man. And it lines up, of course, with scriptural commands of what it means to be a good man. So when we ask men to live up to the scriptural commands, we're not asking them to do something that's alien to their nature. You know, we're not imposing something on them that is contrary to their own nature. The studies show that this is the natural inclination of men all around the globe. I would say it's general revelation, right? General revelation is a theological term, meaning what we can figure out just because we're made in God's image, we live in God's world.
Right.
And the Bible is special revelation. So apparently this is part of general revelation, that men know that their unique masculine strength, right, because men are bigger, stronger, faster, more aggressive, but their unique masculine strengths are not given them to get what they want, but to protect, to provide for, to care for, and if necessary, to fight for those that they love. This is a universal, innate understanding that men seem to have.
Nancy, I know you came from an abusive situation in your family. Let us know how you found your way back to faith.
I found my way back to faith and at the same time overcame my abusive childhood, so it's kind of the same story. I started the book by explaining that I did grow up in a very abusive home. My father was severely physically abusive. And in books on abuse, they will sometimes ask, was it open hand or closed fist? It was closed fist.
Hmm.
You know, it was punching and kicking and when I grew up, well, about midway through high school, I started asking questions about my faith. My family was Lutheran. I don't know if you know this, but all Scandinavians are Lutheran.
Yes, yes.
But what I found, my dad's Swedish, my mom's Norwegian. I find that when there's an ethnic background, sometimes there's less of a really strong personal commitment because parents rely on that ethnic identity to sort of hold their kids. And at any rate, when I started asking questions in high school, my parents had no answers. You know, I was really just asking, how do we know Christianity is true? Because I was attending a public high school, all my textbooks are secular, all my teachers are secular, and I just wanted to know, how can we know it's true? I asked my dad one day, point blank, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me. I said, that's it.
Oh, gosh.
You know, my dad's a university professor. And speaking of Lutherans, I had a chance to talk to my uncle, who was a seminary dean, and I thought I might get a more substantial answer. And all he said was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes.
Thanks a lot.
As if it was a psychological phase.
Yeah.
I would outgrow it. So about halfway through high school, I very intentionally walked away from my Christian upbringing and decided it was up to me, you know, to decide what was really true. And I started reading secular philosophies. You know, I figured that was, Isn't that the job of philosophers, is to answer questions like, what is truth, and how do we know it, and is there meaning to life, and is there a foundation for ethics, or is it just true for me, true for you? And I pretty quickly realized if there's no God, then the answer to all of those questions was no. There's no meaning to life, no foundation for ethics, and so on. And so it was several years later that I was I went back to Europe. We had, my dad had worked in Europe when I was a child, and so I wanted to go back. And that's how I ended up stumbling across Le Bris. It's a ministry in Switzerland. It's French for the shelter. And it was started by Francis Schaeffer, and he was known for his apologetics ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And when I arrived at Le Bris, I was encountering Christian apologetics for the first time. It was the first time I had ever encountered Christians who could answer any of my questions, who could engage with the secularisms that I had totally absorbed by that time. I was totally impressed. And, you know, it was because of that that I did find my way back to Christianity. And I've told my story, you know, in some of my other books, but in this book I told something that I've never told before, and that is that Le Bris also got me started on psychological, spiritual, emotional healing from my childhood abuse. On staff was a psychiatric social worker. Her name was Sheila Bird, and we called her Birdie, and she was the one who helped me to realize I had to work through the trauma of my childhood. I had left home. I had tried to create a blank slate. I said, I'm going to totally suppress my entire childhood and rebuild my whole identity from scratch. Well, you can't do that. It actually doesn't work that way.
Right.
But it was Birdie who helped me to realize the Christianity really does have the resources to provide that kind of deep, profound, transformative emotional healing. A lot of it was just Birdie herself, that she loved me in a way that I had never experienced that quality of love. And so it was easier to experience God's love once I had experienced love from another person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I was very fortunate, I think, that the beginning of my Christian life was very balanced. It was very intellectual, you know, because it was answering all these questions I had about secular worldviews and philosophies. But it also got me started on really profound, deep emotional healing. So it was always that a really good balance that, you know, right from the beginning of my Christian life, I had that balance.
Nancy, the book is absolutely fascinating and encouraging. I know people can go to your website, nancypiercy.com, and find out more about this book and your other books. Is there any other social media that you want to let them know about before we go?
Oh, certainly. I'm pretty active on Twitter. There have been some really hot Twitter debates over this book, I have to tell you. Yeah, it's been amazing. It's been the most controversial book I've written, and I did not expect that.
You're going against the cultural narrative.
When people get into the book, they usually like it because it has a lot of data that people haven't heard, like that data on Christian men. That is just not out there in the public arena yet. But I have to kind of overcome that initial hostility.
It's going to be enormously useful for pastors and other church leaders who are struggling with these issues and the accusations about men. And that's the challenge. And I think that your book is going to be very, very helpful in that absolutely critical work. Thank you for all of the work that it took to put together this book, and thank you for making time for us today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it very much.
We've been talking to Nancy Piercy. Her latest book is The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes, from Baker Books. Her earlier books include Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, The Soul of Science, Saving Leonardo, Finding Truth, and two ECPA Gold Medallion Award winners, How Now Shall We Live, co-authored with Harold Fickett and Chuck Colson, and Total Truth. Her books have been translated into 19 languages. She is professor and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. A former agnostic, Piercy has spoken at universities such as Princeton, Stanford, USC, and Dartmouth. She's been quoted in The New Yorker and Newsweek, highlighted as one of the top five women apologists by Christianity Today, and hailed in The Economist as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. It's been our great pleasure to have her joining us today. And I did have a chance to talk to her years ago when How Now Shall We Live? So I'm delighted to get a chance to reconnect with her. Thanks so much for listening. Remember to check out my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. And of course, you can also check our website at the radio station after this is run on October 22nd. You can check WTBFradio.com, and you'll be able to access that there as well. So until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless.